With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public, free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom, and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Dr. Michael Antoniou is a professor in molecular genetics in the Department of Medical and Molecular Genetics at King's College London. He's also one of the authors of GMO Myths and Truths, the guide to seeing through industry spin. We've been hearing a lot about that on GMOs and making the scientific arguments understandable to the public at large. And Michael is with us, beaming in all the way from the UK. Nice to have you on our radio station. Thanks for making a bit of time for us.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure, Paul.
Okay. The myths and truths thing is going to be really interesting because I think it's fair to say that here in New Zealand, there really hasn't been much coverage at all for a long time on genetic modification, GMOs. We're a food producer, so you'd think that that would be talked about a lot. It's only talked about in glowing terms as a kind of a policy to match the rest, what the rest of the world is doing, and as a food producer, maximize our opportunities. And we're only sort of kind of waking up to things now, and all the messaging through mainstream media and politicians is kind of glowing, you know, and this is the thing to do, and we can't miss out, and, you know, it's all just amazing and progressive and all that. You've heard it all before, so I think it's going to be interesting to go through these myths and truths. First, though, in terms of the messaging through all this time, who's been in control of this messaging, essentially?
Oh, very much the industry and their academic allies as well. They're just very well resourced institutions, very, very powerful lobby. And given their vast resources, they have dominated the narrative really on this issue. And it's been very, very difficult for people that harbor concerns like myself to actually get our message out. The mainstream media seem to be closed on the whole to the concerns that we're raising. And because in this day and age, the public rely on the media for a lot of their information. This is very concerning, as you can imagine, Paul, because they're basically getting just one side of the story here. And for me, as a result, they're getting a lot of misinformation about the reality of what this of these so-called new generation GMOs are all about, and what you can and can't expect from them. So this is why I'm so glad that Reality Radio here has taken on this task, because it's only through outlets such as yours that I believe we're trying to get some semblance of balance out there in the messaging on this incredibly important issue, which is really aimed at fundamentally changing the genetic makeup of our food supply.
Yeah, can I ask a philosophical question? Because I've heard people ask this, you know, it seems like there's this sort of this compulsion to kind of play God, you know, and fiddle with things that may be way beyond in terms of complexity anyone's imagination. Yet they're sort of it's being treated like, you know, we've got this. We've got this. Should we be, you know, at a philosophical level, fiddling with nature like this?
In my view, we're not qualified to, as you put it, fiddle around with nature in this way. It requires a breadth and depth of knowledge, understanding that we just don't have either individually or collectively. Because the point is that life is so complex with no element of either what goes on in the individual and what goes on in the environment, in the wider ecosystem. Nothing is taking place in isolation. It's a complex, highly sophisticated network of interactions. And because it's a network, just fiddling around with one element is going to have repercussions throughout the system in ways that we cannot predict. And this is the key thing here, because things are so complex. You know, we may think in our arrogance with our sophisticated, even computer programs, algorithms these days, that we, you know, we can predict everything that could happen. Oh, well, that's just fantasy. It's way beyond what we're able to predict accurately. And that's what this really, you really struck a very important point here with that question, in that this is what's being ignored even on a genetic level. The fact is that the genes, our genetic complement of every organism, whether it's human, plant, animal, our genetic complement is an incredibly sophisticated network. No gene is working in isolation. And it's working as part of a network. And the products of the genes, the proteins, the RNA, they're working as part of a network. And so this is why all this talk about changing just one gene and we can predict all the outcomes is just scientifically inaccurate. You change one gene, you change just one gene, it's going to have an effect throughout the network. And that's going to affect the biochemistry of the organism. It's going to affect its composition. And in the case of plants, we'll get on to, no doubt, the gene editing element. And I think this has got, I hope, what will be the focus of our discussion. Mm. This gene editing is, although being touted as being precise, predictable, and safe, is actually completely the opposite, and runs the high risk of changing the composition of our foods in ways that could produce new toxins and new allergens, okay, as well as unknown consequences on the environment. I mean, you know, we can't ignore that either.
Yeah, and they might take time, too, to work through, right?
Oh, absolutely, yes. That's right.
In terms of, okay, gene editing, I've done a lot of tape editing in my time, you know, editing words and...
Yes,
and that sort of editing is that kind of what can be done now? So you can like snip one gene out, put another one in its place, edit the ends together, or whatever. Is that how it actually works?
To a degree, yes. The whole idea why it's called gene editing is because of its the developers of gene edited products are trying to do is to make a targeted change to the DNA, to the genome of the organism. And that gives the impression of precision.
Yeah.
And that's why gene editing is called precise, because it's trying to make a targeted integration, a targeted alteration to a given region of the DNA of the organism. And that could include destroying a gene function or changing the gene sequence so that its product is altered in some way and gives it new characteristics. Or you can even insert a completely new genetic element, a completely new gene even, into a predetermined location. And it's these sorts of elements or components to gene editing that gives the impression of precision. But The point go on from what I was saying earlier, the point is that whatever gene or genes, and by the way, with gene editing, it's not as if these developers are aiming just to change just one gene. You know, they're aiming to change several, either sequentially or simultaneously. But changing just one gene is going to risk disrupting the network of gene functions, as I was saying earlier, in unpredictable ways that could have catastrophic downstream consequences with respect to composition and the performance of the plant and its composition with health consequences. But in addition to that, the point is that the process of gene editing is nowhere near as precise as it is made out to be. The gene editing procedure, when we consider it as a whole, bearing in mind that gene editing is a completely artificial laboratory-based genetic manipulation procedure. Now, just because it's artificial doesn't necessarily mean it's unsafe or something. But the when we go deeply into this, what we find is that the different components of the gene editing procedure, which is growing plant cells in the laboratory, introducing into those plant cells, transforming them with the gene editing tool, as well as the action of the gene editing tool itself, all carry a major DNA damaging, unpredictable DNA damaging component. So in your effort to change one gene with a gene editing tool, the procedure as a whole introduces hundreds or thousands of unintended sites of DNA damage in the DNA of the plant. And that is inevitably going to change the functioning of many, many genes, not just the one gene that you're trying to alter, but the functioning of many genes, and therefore the biochemistry and composition of that plant in unpredictable ways, which, as I say, can include the production of novel toxins and allergens, which is why this technology must remain. If we think there's something useful that we can do with it, and that is also debatable, by the way, if we think there's something useful to be done with it, then it should still be strictly regulated.
Yeah.
So it goes through safety checks. It goes both for health and environmental impact. And that is what we're calling for. I'm not calling for a ban here. I'm just saying, be true to the science. Acknowledge the fact that this technology is nowhere near as safe, precise, and predictable, and safe as it's made out to be, and regulate it so that where once it's, you know, if a product is launched, we're pretty certain that there aren't going to be unintended outcomes on the consumer.
Are there ways of modeling outcomes without, the real world timeline in front of you, because that evolves? because that's another selling point for science technology now, is modeling.
Yes.
We modeled this in our modeling shows, and people do kind of accept that.
Yes, indeed. They put so much trust in these computer models, forgetting the fact that these computer models are limited by the people who create the models, their intelligence, which is limited. They may be very smart people, but let's face it, they're not kind of omniscient, gods or something.
No.
They don't look like them either.
And, gods.
So they're limited by those that write them. And at best, they're therefore only predictive. They don't give you absolute definitive
predictive. Because the computational power for that, surely, sorry to jump in, but with so many variables, so much complexity.
Oh, absolutely.
The computation of that is daunting, isn't it?
Absolutely. You need a computer probably the size of the planet or the solar system to kind of get anywhere near accuracy, probably. So absolutely right. The computer programs at the end of the day are only predicting a likely outcome, which has to be experimentally verified.
Yeah.
Which is why for me, I've used in my own research computer prediction models. And then we go on and test those, because we're not kind of thinking, well, the computer's predicted it, therefore it's absolutely right. No, that's far from the case. So any modeling is an approximation at best, which has to be experimentally verified, which is why I've always said that with these GMO products, plants particularly, but also we mustn't forget that the same technology has been applied to microorganisms. And you probably heard quite a lot of that from Professor Jack Heinemann down at the University of Canterbury on the South Island, isn't it, I believe?
Yes, it is.
And
yep.
And also in animals too. We have to acknowledge that any manipulation of all of these organisms and the prediction of what the outcome is only an approximation, and that we've got to use cutting-edge analytical methods to evaluate whether what we've done and what's predicted is exactly what we want, and nothing adverse, unwanted has happened, which is why I advocate that we use what are known as molecular profiling methods. It's something that I use in my own research, where we've used these molecular profiling methods to get deep insight into the health risks of pesticides and other chemical pollutants. And what these molecular profiling methods are, they consist of what we call generally omics methods, transcriptomics, proteomics, metabolomics, and epigenomics. You know, these are basically methods that let's take the transcriptomics. What that does is it looks at the totality of the gene expression profile. With the proteomics, you're looking at the complement, the total complement of proteins that are there. And metabolomics, the small molecule metabolites, the biochemistry, a comprehensive picture of the biochemistry of the organism. And what these technologies have done is they've actually revolutionized the research and the way we go about clinical diagnosis of
is that because it brings all those components together and looks for the way they work or interact? Is that true?
That's absolutely right, Paul. It tries to give you a more system-wide view, yep, rather than homing in on just one bit and looking at it in isolation from the whole in which it is embedded and working. It tries to give you a system-wide view of what's going on. And so that's why I say, I advocate that if you gene edit a plant, even changing just one gene, but like I say, that when you view the process as a whole, you're going to bring along with you unintended sites of DNA mutation at hundreds or thousands of other locations to the intended site that you've tried to edit. So what are the consequences of that? Well, I say, do these molecular profiling analysis and begin to get an idea of what's going on. You can look at the gene expression profile, the protein profile, and the biochemical profile. And I can guarantee you, because I've seen it in my own research, when we did this once with a genetically modified a variety of maize, corn, is that when you compare the genetically manipulated product to the parent, the non-gene edited, non-manipulated parent from where you got the gene edited variety, there you will find massive changes in its molecular profile.
Right.
And there will be consequences. The potential health risks will be there. And so you need to begin with this. For me, you need to begin with this molecular profiling, and then whatever that tells you, you then go on and further evaluate what these molecular profiles are telling you, predicting may be going on. They may even reveal a novel production of a novel, potentially novel allergenic protein or toxic biochemical that's inadvertently been produced because you've disrupted the network of gene function. There are going to be consequences. And these very real likelihoods is what the developers and the regulators are ignoring to their peril.
And that's what I want to ask you about that. You're a scientist. I've looked at your page. There are countless studies and papers that you've done. Some of the headings look pretty involved to me. So you didn't come down in the last shower. How come, I don't know, colleagues or other fellow scientists are so relaxed about the risk? Well, how do you explain that? Is that overconfidence, or is it?
It is a bit of a mystery to me as to why people have become so complacent. But somehow, this whole idea of making a targeted change to the DNA of an organism using the CRISPR-Cas gene editing tool, because that's really what's captivated people's imagination.
Yeah,
it is the one, and it's what has made all this targeting this gene editing, for want of a better word, so easy. You know, it's no more precise than the gene editing tools that we had before. It just makes the whole process so easy. And somehow it's just captivated people's imagination. I don't know why, fundamentally, because we do have more and more evidence building up how the CRISPR-Cas gene editing tool inherently has a major, how can I put it? It can cause damage, unintended damage. So in addition to what you want it to do, it can cause a wide spectrum of unintended damage. And we acknowledge this in the clinical context. You know, in the clinical context, with the with this, as I say, increasing number of publications showing what a wide spectrum of unintended DNA damage can take place with the CRISPR-Cas tool, not only at regions of the genome that are what are known as off-target DNA damage, but even at the site at which you are targeting to bring about your intended change, there is a high frequency of large-scale DNA damage, including loss of large sections of DNA, insertions of large segments of DNA, huge rearrangements of the DNA, or even a phenomenon known as chromothripsis, which is where the chromosome is shattered and then randomly rejoined again. And this has been shown even in plants, by the way. You know, these things happen even when you manipulate plants for gene-edited plants, and not just for us in a clinical context. But whereas in the clinical context, we recognize these risks, and there are procedures in place to make sure that you check things properly before you're granted permission to go into clinical trials. In a food context, in a plant context, and in an animal, even an animal context, these recognized elements of unintended DNA damage and their downstream consequences are somehow being, for me, incomprehensibly being ignored. And I can't answer your question, really, but somehow it's this idea of somehow be precision, you know, this idea.
Well, even the name CRISPR sounds crisp. It's if you CRISPR and then precision, it all sounds very surgical and very precise. And
it's true. It is. Yeah. Even the language of it can lull you into a sense of false security.
Yeah.
And that's what it is for me. It is a sense of false security. And I hope that the advocates of using gene editing in an agricultural, you know, especially in a plant context, just wake up to this. But there is such a commercial imperative drive behind
patents,
this.
And patents, I think, right? Patents.
Patents. Yes, that's the thing. All of these products are patented, whether if you're an academic in a university, you'll be patenting this. And of course, the industry behind this is going to be patenting it. It gives the control of the product in the marketplace and potentially very lucrative outcomes. You know, you'll make a huge amount of money from this. And I think that's what's also blinding people. For me, I have a saying, if something doesn't make sense, follow the money and you'll get your answer.
Yeah, I think we're always subscribing to that quite often now.
I just hope people are not blinded by these commercial imperatives to the point where they forget, where they have been up to now. They're forgetting, they're ignoring these scientifically discovered risks from this technology, but they're somehow living in a world of denial about this and pushing ahead rather than trying to tighten the regulation around these products. They're weakening them. I mean, here in the UK, as you know, last year the UK government became the first in the world to pass a piece of legislation that effectively deregulates the vast majority of products that will result from gene editing. There'll be no risk assessment, there'll be no labeling, and therefore, all has to do is to register their intention. We've developed this and we're going to do this trial and we're going to market it, and then that's it. I mean, it is horrific.
Yeah.
What we're facing here are horrific consequences.
It's almost like someone wants to do damage. Because, you know, common sense, normal guy on the street here, tells you, be careful. You know, it's common sense. So these, getting back to where I started from, and that's myths and truths. So the first one was going to be genetic engineering. So we've covered that. So it's not precise. The results are not predictable. It's crude. It's imprecise. And the results are unpredictable. That's the reality, right?
That's the reality, really. And as I say, anybody who would do the science properly will arrive at that conclusion. Again, what worries me is that because of the complacency, arrogance, whatever you want to call it, within the industry, they just don't. They produce these things and they check, oh yeah, we've made the change we want, and then that's it. It's like they stop there. They think that that's all that's happened, and they don't check things properly. And therefore, they don't reveal to themselves the major unpredictable outcome of their manipulation and what the consequences of that might be.
There seems to be an equivalence being made too, onto another myth and truth, that genetic engineering is kind of on a par, no more risky, let's say, than mutation breeding. And that's where you find a mutation that happens in nature, you seize upon that and you sort of capitalize on that. But that's kind of a natural process, because that's what nature threw up. Is it no more risky? I know that you're probably going to say it's actually a lot more risky than that.
Indeed it is. It is, obviously, because the procedures are different. You know, the way genetic variation arises naturally in nature, either through natural reproduction, you know, pollination, mating of animals, humans, you know, each round of reproduction produces new gene variants through natural processes that are built in, so that we do have variation arising over time. But what we're finding is that this genetic variation that is arising through natural reproduction is not random.
Right.
There are regions of our genome, of our DNA, that are protected from alteration because they're coding for clearly very vital functions.
So, your basic operating system that really needs to work every time, never fails, totally reliable.
Absolutely right. Yeah. Those, what we call in science, we'll call housekeeping functions, right?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
It's like housekeeping genes, you know.
Yeah.
So that just keeps the system, integrity of the system. And so the genetic variation is not random. But that very also, and this is one of the most fascinating discoveries for me in molecular genetics in recent years, is that where you do see genetic variation arising, where it's been looked at now in bacteria and in plants, is that the natural genetic variation that arises is also not random. It's what's been called as a targeted evolutionary changes. So in other words, the changes that are happening are targeted in such a way. It's like the organism, it's part of the adaptation response of the organism to its environment. So you have this not random, but a targeted evolutionary genetic variation arising through natural reproduction as a part of an adaptation response. So we take a plant, it finds itself in, I don't know, this climate and this soil condition.
Mm.
And if you grow, as the plant reproduces year after year in that environment, you find that it's adapting, and it's adapting genetically and it's adapting epigenetically. And so what happens, the genetic variation that arises, oh, and by the way, I bet you any farmer can tell you this. For farmers who save their seed, I bet you they will tell you that as they save their seed from one year to the next, that their crop improves.
Oh, so that you can see it in action, right?
Yeah, you can see it in action. I'm sure there'll be many farmers out there, which I hope will be listening to your program, who will verify this, that they're, you know, one year, you know, the crop gets infected, you know, it gets diseased, but nevertheless, you got some seed, you save it, and then you plant it the next year, and somehow that plant is now more resistant to the disease or the pathogen, or it's more better adapted to the climate and the soil, and the performance improves, and you get better yields. So this is what happens through genetic. So genetic variation that happens naturally is evolutionary, and what happens in the wild, things happen, gets selected for over evolutionary timescales.
Tens of thousands of years.
Absolutely. Yep. Contrast that with the totally random mutation that takes place during the procedure of gene editing. And it's suddenly you put that out into the environment. It is, you know, it's like chalk and cheese. I mean, it's like they don't bear no resemblance to each other.
It's like playing a bum note on the piano, isn't it?
Completely. I mean, I'm glad you raised this, because one of the claims for one of the reasons why people are advocating for deregulation of gene editing is that it just mimics what happens naturally. No, it doesn't. I'm sorry, it doesn't. The processes are completely wrong. Whereas one is kind of non-random selective genetic variation. What we have with gene editing, when you look at, important to look at the procedure as a whole, you end up with massive random mutation through the genome of the organism, and so the procedures bear no resemblance to each other. So even if, and this is a big if, you were able to produce exactly the same type of genetic alteration through gene editing as what may arise naturally in the field in nature. The point is that the processes that you use to achieve that are completely different, with completely different spectrum of unintended genetic variation that may come along with that. The analogy that I like, and as a result of these differences in the process, the risks associated with the final outcome are also completely different. It's like an analogy that I like to use is that, you know, you can produce electricity with an oil-fired power station or even a coal-fired power station, or you can produce electricity through a wind turbine or solar cells. You produce the same electricity at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But the process of getting there to the same electricity is completely different. And so you would regulate the coal-fired or oil-fired power station completely differently from solar panels or wind turbines, because they carry different environmental impacts. And it's exactly the same thing here. The process, sorry.
It's all right.
We must not forget the process, because the process informs how things go wrong as well as how they go the way we want it to. And if you ignore the process, the regulator, inappropriate regulation will be put in place, which in this case is what's been advocated. Forget the process. Just look at the end product. If you can convince yourself that, yes, this is something that could have occurred naturally, then you don't have to regulate it at all. That is absolutely mind-bogglingly disingenuous. It's completely against the science and puts health and the environment at risk.
Just a quick question. Does the broader kind of natural engine mechanism, would it recognize or how does it react to something that's been altered in the lab way, you know, and hasn't run a normal course of evolutionary development? You'd think that system would notice that. It's like a kink.
Yes, it is. I'm not sure. Nature may recognize it. I mean, the
I just wonder what it ultimately does to it. It hammers it down, smashes it out, gets rid of it. I don't know.
Well, you have to remember these things have been introduced into an artificial agricultural context. And so it's a forced situation. And if you suddenly find that you're gene-edited wonder crop doesn't perform as well. You have to prop it up artificially.
Yeah.
With external.
So you're going
inputs.
In deeper. You dig
the hole deeper. You know, the whole idea, we'll be able to use less inputs, less herbicide, less pesticides, and maybe less fertilizers and that kind of thing. Well, there's no way of whether you will succeed in that. And you may find that your crop performs even worse than it did before, and you'll have to prop it up artificially. And this brings
me of the farmer's experience. It opposite sort of raids of the farmer. Every time.
Yeah, it and this is what's been observed. I mean, what we call the first generation genetically modified crops, the ones that involve transgenics, which is the introduction of a foreign gene into them, like the GM soy and maize that was made tolerant to glyphosate herbicide. Now, those crops, what was seen early on was what using these technology was yield drag. This was the term that was used.
Yield drag.
In other words, because of the unintended damage that was done through the process, the crop, it may have been tolerant to glyphosate, but it didn't yield as well. And so they had to make up for that in other ways. So the same thing could be observed with this gene-edited product. There's no reason why you shouldn't. And you'd have to artificially prop it up with higher inputs.
Yeah.
And maybe if you don't mind, Paul, I'll just go on to a point leading on from what we've just been discussing. Now,
sure.
On this very long wish list, and that's all it is at the moment, by the way, when you have the advocates of gene editing in agriculture, when they say what we can, if you look at what they say they can do, it's really a huge wish list.
Right. In their dreams kind of thing.
Yeah, it's dreams, you know, higher yields, pest resistant, pathogen resistant, lower pesticide use, et cetera, et cetera. It just goes, you know, higher, better nutrition, you know, the list is as long as your arm.
Yeah.
Even though there's no evidence really that they could robustly achieve this. Now, why is that the case? Well, many of these desirable traits, such as, let's take disease resistance or infection resistance of the crop to some fungus or something, or higher yield, these are what are known as complex traits. And so, in other words, it's not just the functioning of one or a few genes that confer, say, drought tolerance or pathogen resistance or higher yield. It's the functioning of the whole genome of the plant. It's the totality of the functioning. The many gene families working together within the context of the whole complement of the genome, of the DNA of the organism, that confers these what are known as genetically complex traits. And the only way you can bring about these combinations of gene families to give you a complex trait is through natural breeding. Because it's the only way that brings these families together. Gene editing is only going to be able to do, you know, play around with a few genes. And say you alter one gene and that is whose product is crucial for the infection of the fungus. How long is it going to take for that fungus to change, adapt, so that it bypasses that one gene block? And then it starts to, you're back to square
one. I'm thinking that's a pushover. That's a pushover.
I'm afraid it is a pushover because microorganisms are changing genetically.
Yeah.
All the adapting in incredibly fast rates.
Yeah.
So for me, gene editing, when people who are trying to use gene editing to confer what we call complex traits are onto a hiding for nothing. The basic molecular genetics tells you that you are doomed to fail to bring about these changes in a robust way. You may see a short-term gain, but it's going to fail very, very quickly, and that you're simply better off sticking with natural breeding, if need, you know, to bring about the combinations of genes that you want. You can use biotechnologies known as marker-assisted selection to track the combinations of genes through your breeding. You're not using GM here. You're merely using gene mapping, gene screening methods to allow you to more rapidly select for the combinations of gene families you want. So you end up with your new variety in half the time that it would normally take. And now you know you'd end up with a, because you've brought about the whole families, complement of families of genes, you'll end up with a robust, something that's long lasting, characteristic in your crop.
And
this is the way forward.
And the risk kind of is eliminated.
It is eliminated because we're working with the natural gene pool of the crop that we have been working with for God knows how many thousands of years. And so we have that history of safe use, which gene editing with only a 10-year timeline it hasn't even got a history, let alone a history of safe use.
Could end up actually being a cul-de-sac. It's possible.
It will be. I can get it just like it was a cul-de-sac with the first generation transgenic crops, which did not reduce pesticide yield. It did not reduce pesticide use. It did not increase yields. It did not reduce any other kinds of inputs. It weakened the crop rather than strengthen it. It's for me, it's the same story all over again is about to happen. And that's on the basis of our contemporary understanding of molecular genetics. The way people are manipulating is at odds with how we know the fundamental elements of life to be wired together and to work.
A lot of time's gone by. I didn't get through all the myths and truths. Let's just rattle off just a few quickly.
Yeah, please do.
For just a real quick answers. Strictly tested and regulated for safety. GM foods, that's hype.
No,
right?
Okay. I mean, there was, with the first generation transgenic crops, there's a modicum of regulation in different territories. I'm not sure in the New Zealand situation with... there is some oversight in Europe. We have a GMO regulation in places like the United States. Basically, there was nothing. In Australia, New Zealand with Fasans.
I think we've got a reasonable regulation in terms of the way it's controlled, the research is controlled. But there is a government policy now and lobbying to relax that, okay?
Yes, exactly. So I think we're heading down this route of basically scrapping whatever regulations we have, we're going to scrap them, and there will be little or no risk assessment for health and environment at all. And worryingly also, no labeling. So the consumer will be denied their right.
I don't know how that one gets across the line, that's for sure.
Yeah, well... Here in the UK, it's already law.
There we go. Okay. Do independent studies confirm GM foods and crops are safe? Well, I think you probably answered that.
First of all, especially it's been mixed. There have been some with the first generation. GM food safety evaluation has only been with the first generation.
Right.
Transgenic GM foods. Some studies have shown very worrying outcomes in the feeding studies. Other studies have shown no negative outcome, but it just shows you how careful you have to be, that you have to evaluate each product as it comes along very, very carefully for health risks in controlled animal feeding studies. Long-term, need to be lifelong animal feeding studies to get a real clearer picture of what's going on. With the newer generation gene-edited products, nothing whatsoever at all.
Right.
So all these claims of safety of gene-edited products are completely hypothetical.
Yep.
And they're just based on assumptions and presumptions and beliefs. It's not based on science. And for me, the staggering thing is people aren't even prepared to do the experiment to prove their claim of safety.
Yeah.
And that, for me, is just, you know, it's criminal, I would say.
Well, that goes back to that question I asked you before about, you know, scientists kind of suspending
suspending reality.
The science mindset.
And we're, Yeah. I mean, we're scientists. We're supposed to be the most critical thinkers on the planet, right? You know, this is how science moves on. We critically evaluate. We question each other. You know, we point fingers and say, oh, you've got to do this. You've got to prove it to me.
Yeah.
Why this scientific thinking has been suspended by certain elements in the scientific community on this particular element, I don't know. It's become almost like an unquestionable religion rather than a true scientific matter.
It has a feel of dogma, of religion, high priests and priestesses and kind of,
call them that if you like. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true. Okay. Absolutely true. It's just sad. I'm very sad to say this, by the way. But that's the way that it comes across.
Coexistence, GM crops coexisting with non-GM and organic crops. I mean, it doesn't sound right to me. Can they?
Well, again, history tells us that it's a virtual impossibility because once you've sown your GMO, whether it's old or new style gene editing, there's no way of containing it. And there have been so many incidences of non-GM, organic or non-organic, being contaminated with GM, that that track record tells you that it's impossible to keep the two apart.
Right.
So all the, you know, you can pass any law you like about segregation, but the reality of the world out there in the field, in the environment, tells you a different story, which is that you can't keep them apart. So if New Zealand wants to remain GMO free, which I believe there's no cultivation of GMOs in New Zealand up to now. So it's able to claim, you know, a very good selling point, you know.
Yeah, well, that's it. The other thing is you put that at risk.
You will put that at risk and you may lose markets.
Okay. And for those who promote it as it'll save the world, the yields are great, the crops are better. Can genetic engineering realistically deliver more nutritious crops?
No, nothing better than what we have at the moment. The point is, Paul, there's nothing wrong with our food crops and animals in agriculture that we have right now. Nothing wrong with them whatsoever. They're nutritious, and if you grow them in the right context, you know, they produce the right yields and nutrition that we want. So any problems with current agriculture is nothing to do with the component, the crops and the animals. It has to do with the system. You know, if we believe our current agricultural system has elements of it that are unsustainable because of high inputs, then we need to change the system.
Yeah.
Changing the animal or changing the crop is not going to address the unsustainable elements. If we want to move towards agroecology, then we need to change the system. You can't become an agroecology system by changing your crop or changing your animal. And we don't need more food. Again, one of the elements of what I have to call almost like emotional blackmail of trying to sell these gene-edited products to the world is that we need them to produce more food to feed the hungry millions. Well, the point is we produce more than enough food that we need now anyway. Work conducted sponsored by the World Bank and the World Health Organization shows that we produce enough food now to feed 14 billion people.
Okay, so 14 billion.
Plenty of headroom. Yep. And that the reason why people go hungry is not because of a lack of food, but because of lack of access.
Yep.
That because of poverty. In other words, socioeconomic reasons. Producing more food and not addressing the socioeconomic reasons why of poverty, which deprives people access to the food, is not going to solve the problem. So I'm afraid it's nothing. We don't all this talk about needing gene editing to produce more. It's just the red herring.
Dr. Michael Antoniou, Professor, Molecular Genetics, Department of Medical and Molecular Genetics, King's College, London. A fascinating chat with you. Thank you so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Paul.
And if people want to find out more about you, they can just go to King's College London and probably website and search you out. Would it be that?
Yes, they can search me out. I have a high profile on the internet. They can email me. And if they want to, as I say, I'm co-author of a book with two other great people, another molecular geneticist, John Fagan, and a great researcher, Claire Robinson, who leads GM Watch. I strongly recommend your listeners to subscribe for nothing to the gmwatch.org, gmwatch.org website, to keep up to date with these developments, and also to buy our book, GMO Myths and Truths. And if you email myself or Claire Robinson, we can send you a brand new pristine copy at a very reasonable price.
Yeah. Made the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Dr. Anthony Yu, thank you so much for coming on, and maybe we'll talk again sometime.
I hope so. Do get in touch.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.